the MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of the ExchangeWire MadTech Podcast. I'm your host this week, Anne-Marie Sheedy, CRO at ExchangeWire, and I'm delighted to be joined by Tamara Sword, founder and MD at ThoughtLeader. Hello, Tamara.
Hello, Anne-Marie.
And thrilled, as always, to have our CEO, Rachel Smith, on the podcast this week. Hello, Rachel.
Hello. I do hope listeners aren't getting tired of the sound of my voice. I've been 3 weeks in a row podcast guest, but it is, as always, a delight and a pleasure to be invited by my own team to join the podcast. Love it.
Thanks for saying yes. Brilliant. I'm going to jump straight into our stories this week. The first one is from The Next Web. It's questioning around VR, whether or not it's essential to the metaverse. And this is an argument put forward by a tech CEO. So the article reads about virtual reality is not essential to the development and adoption of the metaverse. And Meta's focus on hardware is detrimental to their efforts to forge a path into the virtual world. That's according to Herman Narula, CEO of metaverse company Improbable, who describes the VR equipment that Meta and others are building as costly and tangential, the main value proposition of the metaverse. Narula argues that presence will be more important to the success of the metaverse than immersion, describing the former as the feeling that the world thinks you are real, as opposed to the feeling that the world is real, offered by the former, and claims that presence can be achieved through everyday hardware like smartphones and computers. The tech box also supports the integration of blockchain technology into the metaverse in order to prevent the virtual space from being monopolized by facilitating interoperability and decentralization. So there's quite a lot in there. And Tamara, I'd like to come to you first on this. And I'm curious to know if you think, is VR fundamental to the metaverse, or do you agree with Narula's assessment here?
I think that it's an interesting one, because I'm sure that Mark Zuckerberg would love VR to be central to the metaverse. And I think many of the problems that we're seeing with Meta right now are they are trying to shoehorn the metaverse around their hardware offer of Oculus. They need to ship these things. And so their concept of the metaverse is very much geared around fully immersive experiences that you'll be tied into devices in order to experience. And I'm completely behind Narula and his comments about presence, because, you know, the metaverse exists already, right? We don't need Facebook and Meta to develop this for us. People are playing in metaverse environments every single day, hundreds of millions of people in games like Fortnite, Roblox, other 3D environments. These are metaverses. And most of them are experiencing this in 2D. And the sense of presence is really real for these people. Mm. So 100% agree with Herman's comments. And I think what's happening right now with Meta is actually potentially quite damaging to the whole concept of the metaverse, because it's so geared towards supporting Meta's existing business rather than exploring what the metaverse could potentially be.
Yeah, that's very true. Rachel, what are your thoughts?
I think I very much agree with Tamara that, you know, I think we're already in part, you know, there's lots of people far more knowledgeable about the metaverse than I am. But, you know, I think lots of people would agree that we're already operating in quite a kind of virtual existence in many areas of our lives anyway. Gaming environments, absolutely, as you mentioned, Tamara, are obvious examples of that. But I also think that even though they are still real transactions, I think our ability to, you know, get involved in the exchange of goods and services in much more of a virtual fashion than we have done or than we used to even 3 and 4 years ago. So what I'm talking about here is not carrying cash around anymore, barely even carrying bank cards around if you live in London. You just basically leave your house with the mobile phone and your keys and that's it. And that, in a way, I think, is part of a perspective that we're already living in this kind of metaverse, this other reality that isn't necessarily, based on transactions that require physical connection. Having said all of that, I think I also agree that actually hardware is not necessarily, it's certainly not essential for moving around the metaverse. But having said all of that, I do think that there is something about a connection between physical experience and reality that just will make anything that is virtual brighter, better, will enhance it. And so I guess my view on this is that maybe hardware is not essential for the metaverse, because I think we've already proved that we can navigate our way around these sort of new worlds quite comfortably and quite easily. And there's also, if you think again of a gaming environment, there's also some, you know, such obvious connections to other forms of entertainment that I think we're really starting to see come alive in that gaming world, that give us lots of reasons to be sort of pretty enthusiastic and hopeful about what the metaverse could offer us in future. And so whilst, those hardware headsets aren't necessarily essential to get involved in them, I reckon they're probably going to enhance the experience. And maybe that's not, you know, that's not Meta's Oculus, but anyone I've ever spoken to that has used a sort of a VR headset has just talked about how it puts you in this completely different environment. And I know this makes me really nerdy and also really old, but I think I've mentioned this on more than one occasion, certainly on more than one podcast. It brings me back to my student days of watching too much Star Trek late at night. And this virtual reality world that they used to be able to immerse themselves in, which they did in their downtime. I kind of remember what it was called.
The holodeck.
Now. Thank you.
Yes. Yeah, you've got a geek on this one, I'm afraid.
Nice.
I speak Klingon.
Yeah, nice. So I wanted a holodeck in my life back then. When I was a student, I couldn't have conceived of really so many things that exist now in the world that we live in today. And so there is a part of me that still wants the metaverse to be a bit like a holodeck, to give me an opportunity to really move from one environment into another one without there being any confusion that I'm now in a virtual environment.
Yeah, I mean, I want the holodeck too, don't get me wrong, but I just don't think that the VR experience right now is actually on Star Trek. They just have that experience. They walk into the room and room assembles itself. They don't have to wear the glasses, no. Right?
Yeah,
I think
point.
One of the challenges we have here is that, yeah, absolutely, there are use cases for using VR and it can be a whole lot of fun and there's many positives to it. But if we just look at like the human brain, we're animals. And animals are programmed when they're awake to be aware of their surroundings. And when you put on a VR headset, one of the things I always experience is a sense of dissonance, cognitive dissonance, because I'm in a world, but I'm personally acutely aware that my physical body is in the real world and I can't see what's around me in the real world. And that is unsettling for many people. Other people can get past that and can enjoy it for long periods of time. I'm just not one of those people. I think we have to understand that humans also value eye contact and shared experiences. Now, when you're playing on your own in your living room, great, stick on the VR, have an even more immersive experience in your 3D world. That looks fantastic, sounds fantastic, but how do we enjoy content? We enjoy it as families, as friends, together. That's been the tradition of culture for as long as human civilization has existed. It's not been something solipsistic that you go and do on your own in a dark corner. Typically, we share these experiences. And when you're in VR, it's really hard to do that. It's not everyone can see what you can see, and it's extraordinarily expensive if you have multiple people to need a VR headset for everybody. So I think there are some really fundamental barriers to expecting VR to be the way that we experience content. And then, I mean, I could get the payoff for entertainment. I absolutely do. I think that's interesting. But you know, we're seeing use cases being floated by Meta where you go to work in a VR headset and, you look at your Excel spreadsheets in 3D with no legs. You've got no legs. I mean, this is so many problems. I have so many questions. But I think one of the things that Herman's really, his voice in this is really important, because let's not forget he's running a company that is working on distributed computing. So distributed computing is going to completely change the way that the metaverse, as we think of it, potentially can operate. It's the infrastructure behind it. So right now, if you play something like Fortnite or an online 3D game, you go on a server, the max capacity on that server is probably like 100 players, right? Mm. And there's no persistence in the world. So if you move, if I go onto a game and I move an item, next time I go on the server, it's gone. It's not there. There's no persistence. So you've got these almost micro metaverses that exist because of the computing infrastructure that, you know, we currently have. With distributed compute, this changes completely. And I believe in the next few, you know, relatively short period of time, we're going to see millions of players playing in the same 3D environment where there is persistence, where there's where the things that you do in these environments will shape them in the future. It won't just go when the game ends, or when the environment, you leave the environment. So that's going to be very transformative because it's going to enhance that sense of presence that people already have when they're in the zone gaming. It's going to, in these 3D spaces, going to enhance that. And I think the human brain is an amazing thing. You know, when you get lost in a book or you get lost in a gaming experience, these are 2D experiences, but the brain is extremely agile at creating a sense of presence from a 2D experience. I will just say there's one company I definitely think everybody needs on their radar, and that's a company called Condense. They're building the infrastructure to do video 3.0. So this is volumetric 3D live video streaming. It's insane. And you put these photorealistic, real-time people who are being filmed, just like you'd be filmed in front of a camera, ported into 3D environments where you can engage with them. It's nuts. I mean, and it makes you feel, when you see an event that's been streamed by Condense in a 3D metaverse environment, like you were actually there. It's like a gig or an event that you have presence at and a different kind of experience with. And I actually think that all of the talk about VR here is almost a distraction on some of the other innovations that are coming out and are going to completely change, you know, the way that we consume content, the way that we interact with each other.
I mean, I think you've raised some really interesting points about that, the seamless experience, the seamlessness of it, and that kind of persistent, always on environment, because that all that brings me back to the idea, the holodeck, the idea that you walk into a room and that is the experience that you're having, and that you don't actually need something else to take you there. And I guess maybe where we're at is just this really interesting period in history in terms of tech development, because it's not just the hardware, but it's also, as you've mentioned as well, it's everything that supports that. It's the software that you will use in order to have a scalable, you know, sort of multi-layered experience, whether that's, you know, connecting with hundreds and thousands of players, or whether that's walking into an environment where you feel like you're at a live gig. That notion of being able to carry off those experiences at scale from a software perspective is just as important as the potential idea of hardware. And yeah, I think it's quite possible that we will look back on things like, you know, Oculus headsets in a number of years and just think, isn't it funny that we thought we needed those things to be in the world that we're living in today, whatever that might look like in another 4 or 5 years' time. But I mean, you know, the idea of it, and the other thing is that I just don't think, you know, back to your point as well about a headset being clunky and the experience of wearing it making you feel as though there's other things that you can't see, even though the whole idea of it is to put you into this other world where you're just focused on that. I don't think these things ever become wide scale until they're totally comfortable. People just don't use them until they're really usable and really comfortable. Even if you think of the really early days of smartphones, I'm not thinking necessarily, you know, the very first generation iPhone, but I'm thinking the first sort of attempt at, you know, at bringing smartphones into the market or internet enabled phones was just so clunky. And people were like, yeah, great, I could look stuff up on my phone, but it's really slow and really annoying, so I'm just going to go and do that on my desktop PC. And obviously we're in a world away from that now, because the experience has become just that much smoother and that much more enjoyable, therefore. And that's when it really starts to get adopted at scale.
Yeah, I think the saying great technology is invisible is a really interesting one in many levels. That doesn't mean that there's no hardware. It's that when you use it, your mind feels like there's nothing in between you and the experience. And I think, you know, examples of like, you know, smartphones where you can just get lost in your phone. We all do it, don't we? Get on your phone, you're in another place, you know, TikTok, and, you know, 25 minutes have passed and you've been somewhere else, right? So, I think that with VR, we've got some way to go before that technology is invisible, just because it is so cumbersome and it kind of goes against the grain of, in some senses, what it is to be a mammal.
A human, yes.
Yeah, yes. Exactly.
But you say that, we've talked a lot about the kind of environment being gaming. There's other opportunities. If you look back to the VR element there, I think because we're immersed in this on a daily basis, and you both described yourselves as geeks, we've got to kind of think about Joe Bloggs out there and where are they at. I had a friend tell me they'd come back from, I don't know, I think they were Turkey or Egypt or something, and in the hotel they had, you know, they experienced their first VR, and I was like, oh wow, okay, what was it? And it was bloody roller coaster that has been out for how many years? 7, 8, 9, 10 years ago, when everyone was starting going, oh, try this, put this on. And that, I mean, for someone that's got a little bit of vertigo, not exactly my ideal experience talking about the
disconnect. Oh, it's naff, isn't it? It's completely naff. I mean,
I know,
and that's
this,
the other
they
thing.
They found it interesting. It's because they'd never experienced anything like it. They were a bit, unnerved.
Did they go and buy it? Did they go and buy a headset?
No, they didn't. Will they?
It's a little stunt, isn't it? I mean, it's not that different to those sort of boxes you can get at the fun fair where you go in and pretend to be in a jet and it jiggles you about. I mean, it's sort of at that level. And I think, you know, my background, launching like one of the first AR platforms and obviously coming up through the rise of VR, you know, the way that brands tend to address these new technologies is truly awful. I mean, nobody wants to see more ads, let alone with a box strapped to your face straight in your eyeballs. And yet so many of these demo VR experiences brought to you by brand X are honest to God. I mean, it's just, you know, I once saw a VR from a very well known supermarket, and their VR experience was going around a supermarket
shopping, which is like just so close to exactly to what you would do on a daily basis. Like, that's not
I mean, you know, it's just ridiculous, isn't it? I mean, you know, step away from the VR is something that I've always said to brands. Mm-hmm. Another one is, you know, going into hotels and there's a VR in the room. Ooh, and you put it on, and what is it? It's like, and it's just their own hotel.
Just leave your room and walk around.
I'm actually here. You know, just absolute, you know, real lack of vision and strategy, and just, you know, just silliness, really. But I mean, I still think, look, don't get me wrong, I definitely think VR's an interesting technology, but I don't see it having really transforming the way that we as a whole society engage with content. I don't think eyewear, especially eyewear that is completely massive. You can't have a cup of tea when you've got the new Oculus on. You can't have a drink of water. It's complete commitment that's required. So
I mean, it's also the videos of people wearing it whilst they're enjoying themselves in whatever environment they might be, are hysterical, right? And it's the idea that anything that makes a human look like that just isn't, you just can't imagine that being adopted.
Yeah, we're self-conscious, right?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. What about, sorry, don't want to take us off track, but what have happened to the Google glasses where you were going to be able
warehouses.
To... Warehouses. Oh, right.
If that, I mean, yeah. I think they actually recently, I was always a hater of Google Glass. Let me just put that on the record. I did say it was a giant load of nonsense. That has gone literally nowhere. I think they've done a new turn of it with Oakley. But when you think about the amount of money that's being sunk into these kinds of things, I mean, like Meta have got what... It's like the NHS budget for a year going into their metaverse, and what we've
and a
got
bit
is
like the NHS
like
budget.
The
it's bleeding at the same rate, right? Like it's not going anywhere. Shareholders,
DOA.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know, it's exactly the same with Google Glass. I think sometimes these big companies, let's not forget, they're really they're advertising businesses, they're data companies, and they do this kind of highly expensive look at me stuff, not because they necessarily believe it's going to pay off, but because it's a distraction from their core business, which is us and our data. And this is a neat little distraction to kind of make them feel more like a tech business. So I'm slightly cynical about it all, but, you know, I'm sure Google are going to pump loads of money.
Google are going to pump loads of money into the NHS to help support us, because we've given them all their data. They just haven't highlighted that. Mm. And I'm going to edit your comment earlier on. I'll put it on the record. Google, bleep or nonsense. I'm just going to take the glasses bit out and then see what. Not really. Moving on. Our next story is from an article on the BBC, and it's the EU's DMA enters implementation phase. So for our international audience outside of Europe, this is the European Union's Digital Marketing Act, and it's been announced that it has entered a six-month implementation phase and is set to come into force in May 2023. The new law could adjust the way that large tech companies, referred to as gatekeepers, operate by requiring them to make their properties available for use by smaller rivals. For instance, competing messaging services will be able to ask large firms like Meta and Apple to use their platforms to host message exchanges. The legislation will also prohibit big tech firms from prioritising their own services in an effort to level the competitive playing field and give consumers more choice. The gatekeepers, designated as such on the basis of criteria around finances and number of users, as well as their market position, could face fines of up to 10% of their global annual turnover if they fail to comply with the DMA. And that figure rises up to 20% for repeat offenders. Now, the European consumer organisation, the BEUC, lauded the DMA as a landmark law for the EU's digital transformation, which will rebalance digital markets, increase consumer choice, and put an end to many of the worst practices that big tech has engaged in over the years. Big tech companies, meanwhile, have expressed concerns that the new law could create safety risks and reduce innovation. Right, Rachel, do you feel could the DMA create a fairer digital space in Europe?
I think some of the sort of critical words to focus on here are when we talk about perhaps the incentives for businesses to comply with this legislation, the potential ramifications of not doing that means that they could face quite substantial fines. But the important words there are could face fines of up to. So in my view, this will all come down to enforcement. How is this regulation going to be enforced, and to what extent are those are those relevant authorities going to apply the full force of this, of the powers that this legislation gives them, in order to put a stop to some of these bad practices that big tech companies have been engaging in over a number of years. So yet again, I think it's a good piece of legislation. It's an interesting piece of legislation. I think it has the potential to be good, to achieve some parity and some fairness for consumers. I mean, it should be, and I believe it has been designed from a consumer point of view rather than from a regulation breaking up large companies point of view. And if it has been designed from that point of view, and it's therefore looking to focus on consumer experience and consumer choice and control, then it should do what it says on the tin, which is ensure that people aren't forced into an environment where they've got to download apps from only one operating system. They should have the option to be able to download third-party apps. They should, have the opportunity to access other services and not just be constantly pushed towards one particular operating company's products or services. And I think all of that is really good. The degree to which it will really have an impact on how these big tech companies develop products and how they push them into the market, how they roll them out through their operating systems, remains to be seen. And I think that comes down to regulation and enforcement of this piece of legislation. What would be interesting as well is the degree to which this could be adopted outside the EU. There's obviously discussion of it being adopted in the UK under, obviously, it needs to be its own separate piece of legislation. And what is the appetite for that? It'll be really interesting to see. And could it be, depending on how it unfolds in terms of, in terms of enforcement over the coming years within the EU, could it be adopted by other countries? Could we start seeing something like this enter the US market? And the reason I think that's particularly interesting is, as I said earlier on, I don't think it's legislation that's designed specifically to focus on anti-competition. I think it's rather legislation that's designed to focus more explicitly on consumer choice. And that's what I think, what I find interesting about it. Will it stifle innovation? I kind of think not, because this is about tech companies' monetization models and business models. And in fact, you know, widening that rather than narrowing that is surely a bigger opportunity, a wider opportunity for more tech players and more tech companies to get into the market.
Yeah, I think you're right. And you mentioned could a few times. You started out could face fines. Sadly, even if they do, has it changed in the past when there's been some repeat offenders? It's a drop in the ocean. They don't give a crap. And the money that they make, it doesn't, it's like, yeah, fine, we'll do it. It's a bit like, you know, people talk in the UK about various wealthy people in Kensington and parking their cars or whatever, because they just love their rich cars and the convenience is easier. So they'll park it and they'll get a fine for hundreds of pounds. They don't care if the return is worth it. They'll probably financially look and kind of go, okay, 10%, that's nothing if we're going to make X and we can stop company Y taking a share of that. So we'll continue and then we'll see if they do it. And then the repeat offences, you know, I don't know. But also the other point you raised, Rachel, which I think is the meaningful change. And that's where I'm keen to come to you tomorrow overall on your thoughts. But, you know, what could meaningful change look like?
Well, I mean, I don't know if a policymaker is going to come up with it. I mean, this is a policies maker's yep. idea of how to stimulate competition. You know, ask the big boys, the gatekeepers, to play nice and make their systems a bit more interoperable to other players. And you know, we talk about consumer choice, but I think I don't know how much of a driver this is, but where are the big EU sort of tech players in this space? You know, this is really addressing the big US companies, I would imagine. And is this going to enable European companies to build new infrastructure, create new solutions and products and go to market? Or is it just going to mean that they're tied into the platforms of these gatekeepers who, in a sense, is this actually going to be cementing the problem that already exists? I don't know. I mean, you know, I feel like there's a lot of legislation out there already that can address this. Mm. Personally, like for 4 or 5 years ago, like, really wanted to see monopoly legislation being applied to Facebook as it was at the time, pre-Meta. You know, acquisitions like WhatsApp, Instagram, you know, it's with their play in Oculus as well. I mean, it was a real land grab for people's attention. And on that basis, you know, it's sort of starting to create a monopoly. Now, actually, in the last couple of years, that monopoly is not quite so much of a monopoly, is it? Because look what's happening to Facebook's business, and TikTok is certainly in there eating its lunch. But, you know, I do feel like there's an opportunity for monopoly legislation to be brought to bear where companies are sucking all the oxygen out of a space. And I think for consumers, you know, we only use 10 apps anyway, don't we, really, consumers? I mean, you've got all these apps on your phone, you only actually use 10 of them. So this idea of consumer choice maybe is a little bit misplaced. But what we should see is those 10 apps shift around. We want to see new tech companies come up. And the trouble is that when you make those, when you're an emerging tech player and you've got to either navigate and compete directly with some of the big players, you know, or you've got to release your solutions on their stores or through their channels, they have this incredible insight into your business and they can snap you up, right? Or they can crush you or clone you.
Which is exactly and what's happened.
And that, I don't see how this is actually going to necessarily help that scenario. What we really need to see is these gatekeepers
broken down. Yeah, no, and I think that gatekeeper element of this, I think, is total nonsense. The idea that, oh, you know, what we're doing here is trying to make these big tech companies, you know, open up their messaging platforms so that smaller tech players could use. I mean, that's just not going to happen, right? Like, it's not. I just don't think that's realistic. I think the only thing that this legislation could do is throw some fines Apple's way for closing down their app ecosystem. Will that really impact consumers' choices? I mean, it should do. Will it change the way that Apple are operating their iPhone operating system? Probably. Well, I don't know. That's a question
mark. I pay for Apple because I want a closed system. I want Apple on top of everything and vetting everything. I don't know what this will mean for that. I mean, is that going to change my relationship with my one of my main tech providers.
I mean, I think
and
could,
if it does,
that,
it's not a choice I want.
I'm well, like, I think that could. I mean, that's really interesting. Yeah, no, that's really interesting because I think Apple are changing a lot of things about the way that they are going to be running their operating system because they're scaling their ads business, right? So I think lots of things are about to change for Apple consumers or iPhone consumers that I think will, raise some eyebrows. But also, I don't know, I mean, I sort of think 10 to 20% in terms of a fine is a lot bigger than what we've seen before. 20%.
That's not global, but it might be that that's national. So I'm going to fine you 10% of Belgium. I mean, who cares,
I think they
said
it was global. True.
Oh, global, okay.
Yeah, but
I mean,
but you're right, though. When it'll all come down to actually testing this legislation in reality, right? So somebody will need to put a complaint forward. They'll need to investigate it. Then whoever is, the governing authority will need to actually make a decision and say, okay, I'm going to apply a fine in this instance. Well, how exactly is that fine going to be applied? And that will all come down to...
Well, and why don't we just pay tax?
Well, you know, I mean, I'd love it if they invented a tax that those companies would pay, but I still think we're quite far away from that.
I think this is the tax, isn't it? Let's be honest. This is the tax. And it makes the policymakers sound tough, right? But like you say, they're not going, I mean, we're not going to see Facebook fined 10% of its Meta fined 10% of its annual revenue by the European Commission. I don't think we'll see that.
I'd be fascinating if we did, though.
It would be fascinating.
I thought you were going to say fantastic rather than fascinating.
No, fascinating. Fascinating.
I think it's just one of those things where they pay some nominal fine and, you know, they wheel out Mark Zuckerberg to say sorry. And I'm sure the DMA is going to result in an apology by Mark Zuckerberg. I think we could set our watches to it, expect it to come in
It's a shame, though, if that's the way it worked out, because you both raised good points and, you know, around what does it actually mean? Will they clone them, buy them, break them, or, you know, what are the terms and conditions of use going to be? Where does that sit with the consumer? Because it's going to be buried, you know, somewhere further than any of the terms and conditions you probably even read when you download an app or depending on what service you're going to use. And it'll open up a whole host of more problems. But like you both said, I think it's something that we're just going to have to wait and see what happens. Right then, our third story is from Digital Trends and it's about TikTok creating a gaming channel. So they launched their own gaming channel, according to a report from the Financial Times. The new feature will be accessible via a tab on the homepage of the short form video app and will include a range of ad-supported games with further content available for purchase, according to sources familiar with the matter. Now, the news follows the ByteDance-owned company's appointment of Asaf Saghi as global head of gaming last month. Saghi will spearhead the development of the gaming channel, writing in a LinkedIn post that TikTok and gaming are made for each other. TikTok first made moves in the gaming space in May when they tested in-app games with younger users in Vietnam. The move follows a wider downsizing by ByteDance of their gaming division. So, Tamara, I'm curious to know your thoughts in this. Do you feel this is a kind of a natural move for TikTok? And if so, how might it impact advertisers' interest in the app?
Definitely a natural move. I mean, we're talking about 1.6 billion users for TikTok. 25% are under 19 and apparently, like, usage on average is like 89 minutes a day.
89?
Yeah, something like that. 89 minutes a day.
Scary.
Average, right? And so, I mean, you know, do you guys think this is a social, do you think of TikTok as a social network?
I think of it as a social media platform. I mean, what is a social network these days? You know, I think most social media platforms enable you to do the messaging thing, but also have that strong entertainment element to it. And really, when I'm thinking about that, I'm thinking more Instagram, TikTok. I'm not thinking Facebook. I don't even understand who uses Facebook these days. I don't think anyone
I do to check birthdays,
it.
But otherwise I'm on MySpace.
Yeah.
Very expensive calendar, isn't it?
You're
a lot
not
of money went into that.
I spend 94 minutes a day on MySpace. Sorry, I detract. Go ahead.
I love it. We remember MySpace, you know. TikTok's users will not. I mean, I definitely think it's a streaming company. And it's got so many advantages over Netflix, because like when you're on there for your 89 minutes a day, you're getting micro content again and again and again. And that's each one of these data inputs from you, the user, that's refining their recommendations engine, getting data for advertisers. I mean, it's really, really phenomenal machine, really, isn't it? And it's changing content and it's changing music. And I think it's going to be big in gaming for sure. It's a bit of a worrying one though, I think, because like TikTok is particularly sticky. Like obviously there's been a lot of focus on apps like Instagram and how they've designed things to kind of get their teeth into especially younger users and keep them coming back for more. You know, there's a, you know, addiction is a real issue with some of these people constantly looking for that positive feedback and that serotonin hit from dopamine or whatever it is from engagement. And I think with TikTok, that's even more the case. And, you know, I was reading that your frontal cortex is responsible for impulse control and it doesn't develop fully until you're 25, or in my case, 45. and you know, that's an issue. We've got this app that is incredibly sticky, where most users are under 25. They're spending huge amounts of time on there. A lot of data about those users is going back to TikTok and its parent company, ByteDance. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting one. I mean, I think gaming makes sense. I mean, Netflix has obviously launched gaming. TikTok, it makes sense. Their parent company was heavily invested in gaming. So there's a lot of, in the TikTok version in China, Douyin, I think it's called, they had games. But interestingly, the Chinese government over the last year have cracked down on that. And their regulators are all over it because of the amount of time young people were spending playing these games on its Chinese version of the app. So it's had to put in time limits and it's really under strict regulatory control in China. So it's very interesting that they're now launching this here. And it'll be interesting to see if those sorts of controls over how young people use this app or anyone uses this app are going to be in the version that the rest of the world gets. And I suspect they won't.
That's interesting. Rachel, what do you think?
I mean, one of the things that I think about connected to this story is, what about the quality of content that you're consuming on TikTok? It's mostly user generated content, right? That to me sets it apart from other streaming. It's really interesting, Tamara, that you think of it as a streaming company, because I hadn't thought about it like that. And you're right in terms of that's its output, right? Its output is entirely content. I mean, video style content. But it's the quality of the content for me that makes me think of it very separately from other streaming providers, classic streaming providers. And I think that user-generated content in our experience so far in life, tends to go in one direction, and it's not usually in the direction of quality. I'm not saying that it's not engaging content or that it can't become professionalized or it can't get better and improve over time. But, you know, what ends up happening generally is that the type of user generated content that becomes really compelling and that people really enjoy becomes rather more professional as things go by. And so as time goes by, and so that's not what the majority of people are able to create, either because they, you know, lack the resources or frankly lack the talent, whatever it might be. So, you know, thinking about it as a source of content and thinking about the volume of content that's consumed on it is kind of alarming. Is it surprising that they've launched a gaming offering? Not at all. This is what all other social media companies and social platforms have done, but it hasn't worked out very well for them. So it'll be really interesting to see what this is going to look like in a TikTok environment. And that's why it's really interesting that you drew that, you know, streaming provider parallel there, Tamara, because, you know, Netflix offering gaming to me seems like an entirely different proposition because of the quality of the content. And I'm not saying that the Netflix offering then would be more popular than a TikTok offering from a gamer's point of view, but I'd just be really interested to see which direction these things head off in, because social media platforms haven't had great success in building out gaming companies.
So here's a question. I don't mean to put either of you on the spot, but let's say I'm an advertiser and I've got my money and I want to know where I'm going to put it. Am I going to put it in VR? Probably not. What's my position in the metaverse? What, you know, what presence do I want to have and how am I going to engage with my audience there? Or am I going to do something on Roblox? Or am I going to come to TikTok? How am I going to make a decision and what results am I going to get? And what are the measurement pieces or what are the expectations in terms of how I'm going to track any investment? I know it'll come down to the objectives, but I just don't know how they're going to have the bandwidth to kind of either go all in or what's it's going to be interesting to kind of, you know, what's the criteria? Because if you take the metaverse, for example, if fashion brands, I think, are actively getting involved there because they believe that for some people, their personal, their digital persona is more important than their physical one. But then the mindset of a TikTok user and their activity versus the mindset of a gamer and how they, you know, the environments that they're involved in, how are they going to figure it out? You know what I mean? What, where would you go to? What's the kind of, I don't know. It's a bit of a
mindset. Well, don't let the tech to determine it. I mean, you know, you've got to have a really good...
At the end of the day, isn't it?
Exactly. It's another bloody pipe, isn't it? I mean, you just got to know who you're trying to get to and not get obsessed with the technology. And I think that's the mistake that agencies and advertisers make is they get really excited about some new technology and they forget, actually, are any of our customers there?
Yeah.
And do they want to see our content in this way? Yeah. You know, they're obsessed with the technology and the latest thing and they're thinking, oh, maybe I'll get an award for this crazy, very expensive, effectively PR stunt. And then the other thing is that the message that they're piping hasn't been, they haven't evolved it to meet the needs of the pipe, so they're trying to ram down something that comes from an interstitial ad into a VR environment. I mean, all this kind of nonsense happens, doesn't it? I mean, I just think it always starts with who's your customer,
exactly,
where are they and how do you talk to them in this environment, you know.
Exactly. And as was pointed out to us earlier on in the year, I think it was at ATS London, very often, depending on what type of brand you are and depending on, you know, on your perspective as a marketer, very often the customer is not you. So you know, the decisions that you need to make about where to put that budget, you know, need to be really well researched and really well thought through. And a lot of the decisions that we might instinctively make are not necessarily heading us off in the right direction, because you're not always looking for customers that you think you know. You know, very often they're customers that you know a lot less about than you think you do. So and then, you know, coming back to your question there, AMS, where would you, if you're a marketer, where would you put your budget? Entirely depends on your objectives, as we've just agreed. But they're different propositions, right? You want to, all the kids are on TikTok, so you want the kids, you go to TikTok. Metaverse is still very experimental, but if you want to throw some experimental budget in a particular direction, it's probably not a bad place to start to see what comes back, because you know at the very least you're going to be able to target some form of a gaming audience, and that gaming audience is becoming more diverse as the days go by. So
I think the key there, you're right, is who are your customers, and that's where I'd like to kind of move on to the second part of the our discussion, which is tomorrow, all about you and your customers. No, I'd like to find out about more about your business, and if you wouldn't mind kind of sharing with our listeners, you know, what is, who are Thought Leader and what work are you doing and how are you helping your customers right now?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, where to start, really? Thought Leader is an agency I set up in 2019 after working in all kinds of tech companies over the years. And I set up the agency because I was just really frustrated I couldn't get the solutions and services that I wanted to buy when I was a CMO. You know, basic stuff like integrating my PR with my content marketing and my lead generation. You know, I can buy all of those things individually, but can I find an agency that actually gets it and joins the dots? No, I couldn't. So I set it up. Our kind of zone of genius is understanding like the current zeitgeist, right? Which is people crave authenticity. People crave something more than the corporate voice. And founders in this world are tech founders are the Odysseus and Achilles of our day. They are the Greek heroes of, you know, and everybody really wants to know what makes them tick, their perspective. And so we work with companies, all of them are tech companies, from Twilio to the world's biggest font company, Monotype, all the way through deep tech, early stage, high growth tech companies. And, you know, I suppose we do different things for different people, but at the heart of it is really just thought leaders don't sell like a product, they sell a perspective. And really, like, we start from that point of view and really use that to shape everything we do, understand who their customers are, what their customers' problems are, you know, try and stop the old classic tech problem of, you know, a technical founder starting with, and I've invented this.
Now you must use it.
Yeah, we try and sort of start with the customer problem and just find that that really cuts through with media and with customers and, you know, generates new opportunities. So that's kind of what we do. And I think it's never been more necessary, really. Just to, tech is such a fabulous space to work in. So much amazing people working on incredible solutions, and many of them just need a bit of a hand kind of telling the world about what they're doing, and that's what we do. So it's all the fun stuff, really. I'm very lucky.
Amazing. Sadly, we've run out of time, but I would just like to thank you both for being fantastic guests. Really, really interesting conversation. Thank you, Tamara, for joining us.
My pleasure.
Rachel, thank you for saying yes to your colleagues.
My pleasure. I might try doing it more often. And I'm delighted to have met fellow Star Trek nerd. And I'm really glad that you brought the word holodeck back into my life, Tamara. Thank you very much.
Well, that's it for this week's Exchange War and Mad Tech podcast. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week.